Bouncing Death Kirk is a weekly Keyforge podcast focused on competitive play. The podcast is hosted by Kata Mode and Codameron. The show is here for listeners to gain a better understanding of how to evaluate decks, how to evaluate their own board position, and how to anticipate opponents' decisions. Without further ado, here's this week's episode.
Welcome to another episode of Bouncing Death Kirk. I am Kata Mode, and I'm here with Codameron.
How's it going?
And today we have a special guest. So we have Eric from Team SAS. He goes by Justin Blinded on Discord. And I believe he also goes by that if you find him on other platforms as well. Now, Eric in particular, the reason we brought him on, as part of SAS, SAS gives a little bit of a unique insight into the Keyforge community because they get to see how sales patterns go, how a little bit more deeper into the competitive scene. As such, Eric also goes to just about every single Vault Tour, and he has managed to top cut at four of them. So we can also use him as another way to bounce off ideas for the competitive side as well, as this is primarily a competitive play podcast. So Eric, if you want to give a little bit more about yourself, and then we'll jump into the topics.
Sure, thanks, and happy to be on. Thanks for having me. As you said, my name's Eric. I've been a Magic player off and on for 15 years or so, so that's kind of like my introduction into card games, as a lot of people I know. And then I found Keyforge last year, really enjoyed it. Decided to go to the Seattle Vault Tour, and that's where I met a large number of people, and a few of us ended up kind of forming the Team SAS thing. I met Z, I met Nathan, Alvin, and Joe at Seattle. We just kind of did our thing, and we've been doing our thing ever since. And I'm happy to be part of the community. I'm happy to be part of the group of friends that we have. And you know, I love this game. And I try to play it as much as I can, for better or for worse. So I'm happy to be on. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I can attest to that. Eric plays this game a ton, and just talking with him about this game, he's got a very good, very very well practiced perception of this game. So I really like his opinions on this game. But right now, well, we want to take this episode to talk about the state of the game as a whole right now. Mm-hmm. Right now, this is August of 2019. We are just post-Gen Con. We are waiting on our first Grand Championships to happen at Nova. And I think there are a couple more Vault Tours to wrap up the Vault Tour season in Europe. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that we've seen with this game evolve since Set 2 came out, AOA. We're going to talk about the balance of the game, where that kind of is in Sealed and Structured in Archon. We're going to talk about how the tournaments look. And we're going to talk about where the game can go from here, given its very, very strong first year, or almost done with its first year, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so this game came out in November, right? And so the hype train on Keyforge is as big as any game has ever had for hype trains. Now, what we want to point out is that there are things that are very, very good about Keyforge, but there are also things that could be a whole lot better. And we want to use this episode as a way to highlight that. So, like, let's lead off with the first thing we want to talk about, which is balance of the game. And, like, where is it out? Where could it be better? And what are the good things that they've done? So, Eric, tell us, what are the balance parts you really like about the game?
So, I think that the game does a good job of, even with two different sets, the game does a good job of trying to introduce a universe where you can theoretically play a bunch of different kinds of decks and a bunch of different kinds of styles or play styles, or even experimenting with different houses. And although there are definitely some situations where there are going to be stronger decks and weaker decks, I think especially AOA is a good example of everyone, you know, knocks AOA compared to Coda, but I think as a self-contained unit for, like, sealed drafting, or not drafting, sorry, Magic, for sealed play.
Limited formats
as a self-contained set, I think AOA is reasonably, fairly internally balanced in terms of, like, there's a lot of different, like, when you went to at the sealed event we just had, there's a lot of internal balance in the set, so I think they do that pretty well, and they make it interesting to play with different houses and different sets, and the combinations are almost infinite in that sense.
Yeah, I really liked Sealed in AOA a lot more than Coda, because I really feel like Sealed in Coda, for the most part, is like, did you get Shadows or not? Is a really big indicator if whether or not you did well. Mm-hmm. But like in AOA, I feel like almost any three house combination is viable. Or at the very least, you can go like 3-1 or something.
Yeah.
So like that was really nice. It just the key control seems to be more spread out. There's also just less, right? So
right.
You don't have a situation where it's like, hey, we're going to concentrate 50% of the key control in one house.
Right.
You know. So,
we've talked about this a little bit in our Stilled episode. I really like AOA in a vacuum, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a little bit trickier when you start talking about it in the Archon format, right? Mm-hmm. Coda decks, racing decks, and even just really strong decks that have all the right cards and all the strong cards, lots of Control of the Weak, Screaming Cave, Time Traveler nonsense. Mm-hmm. Those can still high roll at the and often do really well at the Archon format, especially compared to AOA. It's kind of a surprise when an AOA deck even makes the cut at the Archon.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think the way that I normally think of it is the bell curve. If you like bad decks to good decks, mm-hmm. the bell curve on AOA is much narrower, right? Mm-hmm. So the worst decks in AOA are typically not the worst decks, are not worse than the worst decks in Coda. Like the bell curve extends out far in Coda. Same on the top end, right? The best decks in AOA, with maybe like one or two exceptions, the best decks in AOA are generally not going to compete on average with the best decks in Coda. Because there are just some busted things in Coda that don't exist in AOA, and some of the components of that are very different. So that might be a large part of the reason why AOA tends to play well as a self-contained set better. And I think it will probably be a long time, if ever, we ever see an open Archon event where we have an AOA winner. But who knows?
Yeah, I personally feel like the big reason why we have such a disparity is just that set one has really degenerate racing decks, and set one also has a reasonable amount of amber control, like just like raw amount of cards that can say I pluck one away from you.
Yeah,
you know, especially when you think about the Shadows House, like if you have like a Shadows Dis deck in set one, you probably already have like 12 cards that can interact with amber in some fashion, good or bad.
12 is a lot,
but I mean it's not hard to find if you're trying to find a competitive deck. Whereas you try to do that same exercise in AOA, it is incredibly difficult. And that's really where it's like, the AOA decks that compete, they need to have that. And when you just have a lot less of them, it makes it harder to find a deck that has both the amber control and also the good cards.
And also have it be better than the Coda version of that deck you have. Mm-hmm. Right? I could have an AOA deck that is better than my buddies or some other guys best Coda deck, but that's never going to see the light of day because I've got a great Coda deck instead.
Right. Yeah, I've felt pretty strongly about this game that I don't think racing decks should be a thing. Like, I remember when I first opened my the first deck of Keyforce that I saw, right? Like, this is before the game came out and they had like only the proxy decks. I remember I saw how they had amber pips on cards, and my first instinct was it would be pretty damn broken if you could ever get a deck that has more than 10 of these.
I actually just saw one today randomly that someone found on our team that had 26 printed amber on it.
Wow.
Which is one of the more busted things I've ever seen.
But, yeah, so if there were an imaginary algorithm,
yeah,
I would put in that algorithm that there would be an amber cap, right? Like, there would just be certain cards. Mm-hmm. Like, in the same way that there's a limit of 10 rare cards, there would probably be around that many cards that can just generate amber while doing nothing, right? So that... But when you introduce that into the game, you now change the way your games play forever, because like, these sets are evergreen, right? So you can't say, oh, set one has too much amber pips, we'll just wait until set four comes out and we rotate out set one. That don't work that way. You have to actually live with it forever. So we want this to be solutions oriented. So as far as solutions go, where do you guys think we can fix the problem? There just being too many cards that generate amber in set one, and then we saw with set two, you don't make enough amber control, your toast.
So I've seen some things in the cards that have been spoiled or previewed from set three from Worlds Collide. I've seen some things that lead me to believe that a strong possibility that if there is a power creep, to use, you know, perhaps imprecise term, if there is a power creep in set three anywhere, the place where it should be and where it makes the most sense and where I've seen some cards indicate that it might be is Amber Control. Right? So there are cards that say that you can increase the cost of your opponent's keys for each card that you have in archive. Or, I mean, stuff like Anguish-like effects. Like, Anguish is a card in AOA where you increase for all the damage on the creature. So stuff like that has a chance of putting it in a universe where it could be competitive in an Archon level.
Yeah, but the important thing, which I also kind of have seen a little bit, is that you have to have a number of cards that do that. It's okay to have a Grok if you have 10 of them with different flavors and different houses, right, in that deck, right? It's not okay to have two doorsteps in a deck and be done. That's not okay. need to have 10 or, you know, a big number of small amber control cards every now and then.
Yeah, I would try to have the amber control mirror the amber gain, right? Because if you look at the number of cards in the game that say, hey, do a thing plus gain an amber, or kill a guy, and if you kill him, you get a capture one or whatever, right? Like, there's a bunch of cards that say do a thing plus gain, but not as many cards that say do a thing plus capture or steal or lose, right? So if you were to just make those about even, like level off the amount of amber gain to the amount of amber control, because like you're still always going to have more amber gain than you will control.
You're talking across the set.
Yeah, across the set. So if I say I'm going to make, like the set's what, 300 cards?
It's going to be 400 actually.
Okay, let's say 400 cards. So if I make a set with 400 cards and I say that 150 of those cards are going to have some sort of do a thing plus gain amber effects, make another 150 that say do a thing, take one amber. Right? Because like you're always going to generate more amber than you take by simple the fact that there is a reap action and there is no lose one amber action. Right? So you can always reap to the end. Like the games will end at a certain point, but you can at least make it so it's like amber from hand isn't what determines games.
So I have not seen any evidence they're doing this, but I think one of the interesting ways they could explore this idea of needing to counterbalance amber considerations is they could have aside from cards that light opponent's amber on fire, they could have cards that have costs in them. So what if instead of printed amber on the card, you had printed lose an amber on the card to do something really good? What if instead of Coward's End giving you chains, it said you have to lose two amber to play this card?
Love
right
it.
or something like powerful effects that have a negative value on amber, so that you're not that you're not doing that. Now that doesn't necessarily address the Archon head-to-head matchup with like Coda, for example, because Coda doesn't have those requirements. So you're going to have some of the things that you talked about with the do a thing and hurt the opponent in terms of amber. But that's an interesting space they could potentially develop in the future.
If we take set two, right, I think there's two cards in set two that counteract racing decks, and one does a really good job and one does a really poor job as far as balance goes. Mm-hmm. Proclamation and Grump Buggy. Mm-hmm. I think Proclamation is horrible card design, and I think Grump Buggy is great card design. And the reason for this is that like Proclamation's absurdly easy to turn on.
Mm-hmm.
And so it actually doesn't take away racing decks. Like you'd actually, if every single racing deck could play Proclamation, they would.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it's just like pure positive effects.
Well, right, because Proc is only one-sided.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But now Grump Buggy, dual sided, right? So you could say I want to make this game longer, but you force interaction with your opponent.
Yeah, Proc should have been double sided. That sounds great. Mm-hmm. And then it's a question if you want to play it. It's not just automatic upside. Yeah, I like it. That's great card design. But like, one of the reasons that we haven't seen a Proclamation deck in the top four is that there haven't been enough good Proclamation decks. I mean, either pulled or better than Coda decks on the market. You know, what's your take on that?
I mean, I think the reason you haven't seen a Proc deck in top four is because Proc's in AOA and the rest of the cards would have to be from AOA. I mean, I think it's that simple. When I say in an Archon top four, and I mean, I think that's it because I think, again, I think I am hoping to be proven wrong. Like, I would love if an AOA deck, like, won an Archon Vault Tour. That would be great. But I think that's the fundamental issue in terms of competitiveness.
Well, this is one of the things that I actually had one of my first real frustrations with Keyforge in general this weekend. I was going into the Archon tournament, and I had this Double Sigil Racing deck because that's what I play, and I was excited to play it. And I'm looking at the field, and I'm talking to a bunch of people, and I'm realizing that there's a lot of people on racing decks. And I got this in my head that I had this idea for a deck, and it was Proclamation-centric. It was Daniel's more Grump Buggy, but I really wanted to play some sort of Proclamation, maybe even Orb of Invidious nonsense AOA deck. And even if it wasn't perfect, I would have tried to play it just to see how it would fare against the meta, and I couldn't, right? A big part of that being that a number of AOA decks just aren't around, aren't available, aren't for trade, aren't for sale. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was the first time where I really felt this thing where I was on my more consistent racing deck because it was an easier thing to obtain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't build the deck I wanted.
Yeah, there are just too many cards in set one that have dots on them. And then that really is just a problem. And so now I think every set going forward, you have to do one of two things to have your set be viable. Thing number one, you have to print an equivalent number of dots, right? So you're going to have to go back to making more cards like Dust Pixie and Nature's Call and Time Traveler, like these cards that should have never existed. You're going to have to make more cards like that if you want your set to be played, or you're going to have to make a lot more Amber Control. And that's where I would hope that the design space goes. I would really hope that the design space moves in the direction where they just say, you know what, every single set in the common slots is going to have a bunch of just cards that dink off Amber. That way, you can actually play it against set one and not feel really bad. Because, like, again, with AOA, you really need an outlier deck in order to have, like, your double-digit Amber Control cards. And because, like, if I open up, like, if I went to a store right now and I open up 30 AOA decks, I'd find maybe one that has 10 or more.
Yeah, reality, that's a little rough, but you're kind of right.
I don't know. So, yeah.
Whereas if I went Coda, if I went Coda, just give me three decks that have Shadows, and one of them will have double digits, you know?
I want to call you wrong so bad, but I can't.
And then that's really where... That's why you have so many AOA decks, right? Coda decks, because you can just have all the Amber Control and just play whatever you want. And AOA doesn't... Because, like, there's some baller AOA decks out there that are really fun, and they just lose because your opponent reaps to six and you can't answer them.
And the tricky thing is, it's harder to justify buying these AOA decks. You know, I try to buy one every week when I go to my local, but, you know, a lot of them are just bad, right? A lot of them just don't go together, and if I even pull a Proclamation, it just doesn't look good with the rest of the deck. It feels a lot worse, and I hope that they fix that with Worlds Collide. I just want there to be more excitement for buying these decks, because you pull one and it's reasonable, you can play it, you feel good about it, it works together with itself.
I think even if third set is not perfectly balanced or doesn't counter AOA as much as we would like it to, I think barring some sort of very weird thing we can't predict now, third set is going to be exceedingly popular, if for one reason and one reason only, and that's because they added two houses, right? Yeah. I mean, that's the houses look really cool, by the way. Like, everyone I've talked to is super. I'm a Star Alliance person. Like, I'm gonna like that a lot more, I think. And I know, like, people that I've talked to are big Dinos people, so you have your favorites or whatever. But, like, I'm really looking forward to the new set, just seeing, because we have kind of an established, not really meta is not the right word, but establish house identity. That's what I'm trying to say, for what each house is trying to do. And I'm really curious, I mean, we've got kind of some of the flavor of it already, but I'm really curious to see what the flavor of the cards looks like from these new houses. Because this is their Coda, right? This is the first time we've ever seen them.
The behind-the-scenes reason of why I really want this to generate more decks bought is because then it makes more decks sold, and then you get back into this thing when the game was still fresh, which we were talking about when one of our first episodes of, you can just go on eBay and find a deck that someone thought was kind of okay and realize, oh my god, this is fantastic, right? That's when you can really find these game-winning decks early on, right, for cheap without paying a ton of money to win this game. You can buy a reasonably costed deck on Decks of Keyforge or on eBay or whatever for 30, 40 bucks. And that's the one I took to the Vault Tour. I didn't do so well, but I know it's a good deck. I bought it for 40 bucks, and it came with another one.
Yeah, right. The pay-to-win is something that I think as a community we need to do a better job of dispelling, because I've seen this a lot in my community where players will start the game. And now this is largely due to the fact that racing decks exist, but, like, they'll get their teeth kicked in a way that's just brutal. Like, they're losing, like, five turns. And they're like, yep, that guy must have paid 200 bucks for his deck. And the reality is you can find really, really good decks for very cheap. But I think this is largely on the community to say, hey, guys, this game is not pay to win. Like, if you hear someone saying that, you gotta nip that in the bud really quickly. Like, Eric, what's, like, the average price of a deck on Decks of Keyforge? Like, do you have that number?
No, I definitely don't know the average number. I will tell you that after the errata, that there was, at least at the high end of the market, it kind of fell out a little.
For the
right?
C.
Because, what's that?
For the lands decks.
Well, obviously those decks just aren't worth anything anymore, or are usually not worth nearly as much, but, like, there's a, once... once it's one of those moments in a game where you, it was kind of inevitable looking back on it. But when it was occurring at the time, it's one of these things where people said, well, like, I wasn't aware that this was a thing that could happen because it kind of just came out of the sky. Like, they had always, there have been complaints and people had asked for something like this to happen,
yeah.
But a lot of people were just not aware that would happen. So now if they have all these decks that, even if they just open them, right? Like, I opened a Lands deck, right? And and it was like a week and a half before the errata. I opened a Lands deck. And then it's like, well, I guess that's not a deck I'm playing anymore. So in competitive Archon, it's still fun to play. But, I don't know. I think if I had to guess, to answer your question more directly, if I had to guess, there are a lot of decks that are listed for at or not much more than the cost of purchasing a sealed deck, right? There are a ton of decks online, because I've listed some of my, like, excess decks that I think are probably fine to play, and it's entirely possible I missed something in there where, you know, where they're listed for 10, 15, 20 bucks, right? You know, so you can easily find decks that have a shot at doing really well.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really easy to compare. I'm paying 30 bucks for this deck that I really like the cards in. I'll buy a double sigil deck for 30 bucks because I love double sigil decks and I want to see what they do. And I guarantee you that's going to be more fun than I have with three sealed decks.
Right. Yeah. I mean, especially if they're three AOA sealed decks, right? If you're talking about Archon.
Oh, sure.
Right. But yeah, no, I mean, I think that's true. And I think that people may not realize that that there's a lot. I mean, and even if someone has gone through a process and evaluated decks and they think they know exactly what the deck is supposed to do and they haven't done very well with it, there's a very good chance in this game, maybe more so than any other game, that even people who are very good at this game and do this a lot can miss. Like, I've looked at decks online before and I've missed what they do, right? I mean, I kind of get what they're trying to do, but I've missed how well they do it.
I do the same thing, but I'm only sitting across from the deck and I'm losing to it.
Yeah. So I mean, it's an imprecise evaluation system.
All right. So I think this ties really well into another topic we had, which is rulings, right? Now, because I think there's good and bad rulings, and I think that the Lance situation was a very good ruling, as was Bait and Switch. Now, this is mostly due, like, I think there's a couple people that don't like any sort of balance changes, and I think they're insane. Like, I've played a lot of games, and like, balance changes always happen.
Yeah, like, there's the... Okay, so we're talking about two slightly different things. There's erratas. There's things that change in the game. Biomatrix Backup was one of the first ones, and that was a very clearly important one to change.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the seed and the bait and switch, and who knows what's on the horizon. There might be a combo that comes out. There might be a combo in this set that we haven't figured out yet that might get errated one day. But there's also rulings, and this is more... I think this is actually something that will always come and go with any card game. Right now, in August of 2019, we're talking about Archimedes. We're talking about destroyed triggers. But I think that very soon, it's been confirmed that we're going to get a timing structure chart. We're going to know with much more precision about when things are supposed to happen, which I'm sure will bring up all sorts of other questions, but we'll have a document to start from.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that we're going to have some sort of timing chart, hopefully before the end of the month, before the end of August, which would mean it would hit before...
Cross your fingers.
What's that?
Cross your fingers on that one.
Yeah, both fingers, all fingers crossed.
I think that FFG thinks that Christmas happens in August, right?
I mean...
Basically.
Sure. But, I think a timing chart is definitely badly needed in the community. I think it's good that they're doing it. From my moments in talking to people at FFG, when I've run into them at cons or whatever, like, I think that they understand that this is a thing that needs to be done. And I think part of it, the problem is that this game did way better than they thought it was going to do, from what I understand. Like, it outsold even the most optimistic projections. So that's a great thing, right? And they have to harness that. So it's kind of a thing they're working on. But having consistent rules is incredibly important at every level of the game, right? It's just incredibly important.
Yeah, due to the complexity of this game, we're of the opinion, or at least I know that me and Dan will talk a lot about this, that this game is meant for the casual player on the whole, which is the opposite of what we are. The competitive player is a competitive podcast, right? And the casual player probably, you know, maybe once or twice will come into the, you know, these complicated rulings, Archimedes. I've seen, there's all these great pictures online
like
of
Duma.
What happens in this. Doom of the Martyr, things with Lion Bertram where things die and then things shift over with destroyed triggers. These are all great questions, but probably more so important in the competitive scene where these intricate things might come up more. Right?
So I, I actually like... Oh, sorry, if you want to...
Yeah. So what I would point out is that, so this game, while designed for more casual players, we've seen this in Hearthstone. Hearthstone's designed for casual players, and there's a very big competitive scene as well. Like, any game, if you take it seriously enough, can be competitive.
Yeah.
And this is where the rulebooks matter. So FFG cannot write a rulebook to save their life. We have a long history of this.
Yep.
Now, here's the difference between KeyForge and, say, Star Wars: The Card Game. In Star Wars: The Card Game, the player base was like 200 people. Right now, it's 200 dedicated people, but it wasn't that many, right? And they already had our money, no matter what. We just loved that game too much and were zealots. That is not the case in KeyForge. KeyForge has over 1 million decks in the Master Vault. There is much more money at stake if they mess this up, right? So if they keep fumbling the rules, because also, like, a lot of the cards that they've made, the solutions to these cards is they're like, oh, we're just gonna make up rules precedents out of thin air, right?
Well, they don't have a lot of alternatives, right? Because, like, I mean, the problem is if the longer that the game went on without a lot of clarification, like, rules started being made and people just kind of... part of my interpretation of why there's been so much frustration over the rules is not so much that the rules are different than what people would have want them to be, but that they were unknown. Like, they're still largely unknown in certain places, and we've been playing it for a while. So there's going to be this natural... like, people don't like being told that what they've been doing for, like, 7 months is not actually the correct ruling. Whether or not they had a reason to believe that was the correct ruling, it's not so much they were doing something that was outrageous, but it's just they didn't know. So the longer it goes on without having a defined set of parameters, you know, the more difficult it is to rein everyone back in.
That feels like annoying at the competitive level, because you hear things, you talk to other competitive players, you have your ear to the ground for news and updates and erratas and whatnot. But for the casual player, and they come across this thing, and they ask online and they don't really get a good answer, it can destroy their interest in the game.
Yeah, I can. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, the rules, as written, are pretty bad. Especially the do as much as you can rule. Mm-hmm. Like, that's awful. Now, the benefit of it, though, is that if you read the KeyForge rules, it's very easy to go from two players have never played a game, they have a rule book, they have two decks, they're playing. Right? You can go from zero to playing at a very high speed, whereas if you make a thicker rule book, it becomes harder and harder. And to me, the solution is you do it similar to the way DBS did, or the Dragon Ball Super Card Game. Now, that game has its own set of problems. The rule structure was not one of them, because what DBS did that's very smart is they had one set of rules, which is the if you need to learn how to play, this is your set of rules, and then they had this absurdly big rules document on the side that was like, it was like a PDF, it was almost like an FAQ sort of thing, but it's just monstrosity of rules and time structures. That's what I would hope that KeyForge does. Like, you can keep the initial rulebook. If you want to have the do as much as you can rule, that's fine. But when you have that sort of a vague rule, you need to explain all the nuances in that rule.
Mm-hmm.
And then also when you have mandatory triggers, which is also kind of a suspect rule, it's like, that's fine, you can keep it. But you're going to need to explain a lot of interactions. And that's where having the mega rulebook on the side, I wish it would have came out with the game, and not almost a year after the game has come out. But hey, look, we're here now. Like, we need to see this thing moving, you know, in a direction where it's good for us.
Yeah, no, I think that's true, and I think that it's whether or not it's a mega rulebook or anything. I think just a basic timing chart, like the one they're working on now. I think that would provide an enormous benefit, because you mentioned it earlier, the disruption that a casual player would have, I mean, I can imagine, by going to an LGS and then one day someone comes in with an Archimedes deck and they played Archimedes several times before, and all of a sudden they play Gateway and they destroy the board, and someone goes, okay, I'm just scooping up my board and sticking it in my archive, and they're like, why does that happen? And you try to explain, and it's just like, you know,
I think another good thing to say is where are these rules coming from? You know, because the one of the bigger conflict issues with the Archimedes ruling is that it came out during Origins, and it was kind of decided upon. It was, I think, correctly decided upon. I think that's how that interaction should work. But it wasn't from FFG from the top. It was from Carson, who is the head North American judge.
So the Archimedes ruling. So Carson had a preliminary understanding of what the Archimedes ruling was, and then he had a conversation with members of the dev team. Like Brad was at Origins, mm-hmm. So we had a conversation with Brad, and based on that conversation, it was made clear that this is the way Archimedes works, and that's why it was like, because my understanding was that the initial ruling on how Archimedes works was going to be different. Right, that was not going to be how it was. It was just going to be like the way you would expect Archimedes to work.
Right.
But I agree with you. I think that that's incorrect based on the way that the rules traditionally operate and how we understand triggers to work.
Yeah, my concern is less with the actual ruling itself, because I think whatever, one way or the other, I'll just play it however it's supposed to go.
Yeah.
I would like, there was a vault cast or something a couple weeks later that addressed that ruling, and I'm like, okay, now there's an official thing that says this. I wish we had a better conduit with FFG for talking about these interesting things that come up. Maybe a Twitter account that is official, you know, at a bare minimum. And then every time they make a ruling, it goes into an official FFG monster manual, like we were, like DBS, right? Something like that.
It would be nice.
Or something.
It would be just, nice. Just
any sort of centralized location.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because right now, a lot of the rulings are like, I took a screenshot of Discord. And that's how we know the ruling is what it is.
Or you're hearing it second or third hand, and you're referring it, and you can't find the document. You couldn't find the post. It was deleted. It was on a video. I had a stream, and I talked to Carson, and like there were some rules that we weren't sure about even. I wish there was something central. But as far as FFG goes, this is really par for the course, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hoping that with the resources that they are acquiring from – doing really well with KeyForge, they could do a little better with the rules this time around.
I mean, the key to me is just having both consistency and a centralized location. Like, mm-hmm. right now, there's not, other than maybe like a Crucible cast, there's not like one person that I can point to or one source that I can point to, and I may be just missing it, but there's not one source that I can point to that says, okay, if that person or that entity or that group says this is a mm-hmm. rule, that's the rule. Right, I'm reasonably certain that if it comes off a Crucible cast, that's the rule. But beyond that, like I don't, that's kind of the problem. Like we don't know where we're going to for rules. They have an email, which I'm hoping is pretty legitimate. I believe it is. I've spread some stuff off there. But if the email is just issuing individualized rulings to people who ask, and that's not being publicized, that's kind of a harder thing for the community to know about. Right. Also, they keep getting the same email, I'm sure, if it's not publicized. Yeah.
Anyway, do we have anything else to talk about rules? Rules are weird. Rules are hard. FFG is not great at rules, but we hope they get better, right?
Yeah, basically, just, you know, make if nothing else, make a PDF document that you can modify, and we can just look up.
And and then I guess in FFG's defense, I'll give him this one. We talked to Tyler in our last banter session or one of them, mm-hmm. and basically it takes a long time. You either have to have this laundry list of things, and then you update a PD, update the rules document, the one master rule book in the FAQ, or something drastic has to happen where they put out a PSA. And we're right now asking for a different system, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Exactly.
Talking about different systems, this is going to be a great transition. Tournament structures. There are a lot of different ones of them. And recently, we just got announced, we're almost done with the Vault Tours. We're done with all the America ones. There's going to be a couple in Europe. We have a Grand Championship coming up. And mm-hmm. just like today or something, mm-hmm. maybe even a couple days ago, the Prime Championships were announced, which are kind of like regionals. And we got information about the format they're going to be. We got information about the prizes, the prize support, which I think the mats look super cool. Not going to lie. I'm about that dragon first place mat. the keys are the same, but I don't like the look of keys anyway. That's another story. You get amber shards. And the format is going to be you can do – your store can pick whoever gets it. And then you can do Archon or Sealed solo. And then you can do Archon Adaptive or Sealed Triad, which – okay, I'm going to start talking here. I'm a big fan of flexible, choosable formats, because I think that's fun, right?
Yeah.
But it's not for everybody.
I would personally have a preference for like the adaptive. But like every store being able to choose is good, that you don't force someone's hand. The thing that I really want out of the tournament structure is I want there to be a new standard for what it is. Because like what's become very clear is that the standard format of KeyForge for big events is single game Archon with adaptive finals. And I don't think anybody likes that. Because, like, I think if you're a super competitive player that likes adaptive, you don't want to be playing single game Archon. And then if you're playing adaptive, the deck that you bring for Archon is not the deck you want to bring for adaptive. Right? They're two different decks. So, like, in that scenario, I would prefer that we move towards a system where we can actually try to have a more comprehensive event. And it's hard to figure this out.
So there are also timing issues, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there are timing issues for just in terms of logistics. Like, if you had to my knowledge, I believe it's one of the European countries I've heard for their nationals, I think it's Germany, is having an all-adaptive tournament. In the past, I've asked about that, and I've been told various different things that, like, it would be, and I understand why, it would be, if you're doing a true adaptive tournament, like the whole tournament is adaptive, it's longer, right? Or you're cutting rounds out. Like, it's by definition longer, because the time limit for adaptive matches, I think, is 90 minutes. So that's...
I thought it was 100.
It could be 100. Actually, it's probably more than 90 minutes. I think there's a different time for Archon Adaptive and for Sealed Adaptive. I think Sealed is always longer, regardless of what the variant on top of Sealed is.
Oh,
I think that may be true. It might be 110 minutes. I don't remember exactly. But it's whatever it is, it's definitely longer. Somewhere on, like, the 2x range of time per round. So that's been a logistical issue, I know, with running a lot more than just the end round Adaptive.
Yeah. Now, one format... There's two formats that I really like. One's not compatible with Gem, the other one is. And so Freddy, who's in our Discord, he gave a format that at first I didn't like, but the more I've thought about it, the more I like it. And it's single game adaptive. And so the way this works is both players put their deck on the table, and they get to look at the opponent's Archon list, you know, for 2 minutes, just like any other game. And then you go right to bidding. So the idea of this format is you have your deck. You'll understand what types of cards hurt your deck and what types of cards don't hurt your deck and what you're strong against. So what you do is you look at your opponent's deck and it's like, oh, they have a bunch of answers against me. I'm going to bid higher on that. And then if you look at their deck and like, deck looks bad, you're good. And to determine which deck you'd bid on is actually pretty straightforward, because that was my first question. I'm like, okay, well, how do you know which deck to bid on? And he said what you could do is you just blindly select which deck you want. And if you each pick your own deck, then you're just playing your own deck at zero chains. But if you each pick, like, let's say you pick your own deck and I also pick your deck, now we're bidding.
And the fun part is if you pick each other's decks, then you're playing reversal.
Yeah.
I've heard
which
it,
is also true. Fun.
I've heard it
I
called
can imagine
as,
some scenarios where that might happen.
I've heard it called adaptive short, which I think is a great name for that format. I'm also a big fan of it. I think it's super competitive. I think it's also kind of fun. I think it's got this level of skill versus randomness. I'm a big fan of it, and that would be a great standard for Archon tournaments, I would think. I think it's less good for Sealed, but I think it's a very good Archon format.
I think it's great for Sealed, and let me tell you why. I hear what you're saying, but the downside to Sealed is you haven't played it as much, right? So you don't know what you're coming in with. But I think having something like that versus just a Sealed solo, where you pick one deck and go head to head, the variance in power levels in a Sealed tournament where it's just Sealed, even if you patch the RNG a little by having them open three decks and pick one, I think the variance in power levels is going to be very, very different in Sealed versus in like higher level competitive Archon tournaments. So I think that actually that may work better in Sealed.
Yeah, no, actually I can see that. And honestly, it seems like one more step pre-game that lets you identify the better player, right? Which I know is a big thing for a lot of people, especially who take this game competitively. We want to see a winner that is, you know, a little bit random because we're playing a card game, but we want the player to be a strong competitor with a strong deck and prove themselves.
And that also decreases a lot. That decreases any factors, and I agree with what Kiermode said earlier. Like, I don't think that this game is as much a pay-to-win game as other people may think. Like, given who I am and what team I'm on, and like I get that that's kind of like a weird thing for me to say, but I don't think it is. But I do strongly, personally prefer formats that reduce or eliminate that aspect. And the format you're proposing, any sort of adaptive, but specifically that format, would reduce that immensely. You would show up with a reversal deck, right? Your deck's never getting chosen, but you're still, you have as much chance as the next person to win an adaptive round or win that
well,
matchup.
The beauty of Freddy's format is You could literally buy a deck off the rack and win Worlds with it.
Yes. Right.
That's the beauty.
I love the idea of, what if I bring a garbage deck and just get really good at playing under chains? What does that even mean? What does it mean when two garbage decks come up against each other? That seems like a really varied format and like almost a healthier metagame by having a use for all these garbage decks.
And adaptive and specifically that, it dramatically increases the number of decks you would consider bringing to a tournament and playing with. And it also explodes the number of strategies that you have. Like, one person may say, I love this garbage deck I have, garbage being a relative term. I love this garbage deck I have. I want to play it all the time. I'm bringing this deck, right?
Yep.
And they could say, I know I'm gonna almost always be bidding on the opponent's deck, but I'm just going to make them play their deck of chains, and I'm better at playing this. You know, there's so many different strategies.
I would bring a combo deck that's ridiculously complicated archive rules. You're supposed to archive all the logos cards for some reason. Yep. And then I let my opponent play it. They don't know how to do it. I play it myself, and I do it great without chains. I would love that format.
It encourages more of a diverse play style.
Yeah.
The other one is the format that was initially announced for the Denver Vault Tour. Now, that one's phenomenal.
Explain that one.
Yes. So the way that one works is you come to the event with three decks. And at the start of the game, your opponent will show you three decks, and they get to just ban one of them.
And these are Archon decks.
Yeah, they're all Archon decks, right? So the three best decks you have. And you say, okay, I'm going to ban one of these decks. And then they ban one of your decks. And you take the remaining two decks, and you pick whatever's the one deck you feel that you have remaining. You pick that one deck versus whatever you feel works best against them, and you play best of one.
And there is so much rock, paper, scissors, cat and mouse decision calculations, because you just said kind of almost automatically take your best three decks, but that may not be the best strategy, right?
Yeah.
You may want to toolbox a deck that is, because you're only going to have to be playing one deck in the matchup, you may want to toolbox a deck that is really good against a particular thing in the meta, right?
Yeah.
And so then you're forcing them to strike your toolbox deck if you run up into that matchup, and then you're playing one of the, I mean, there's so much,
I mean,
strategy
it would be
deep.
It'd be a lot like Hearthstone, where your decks are not independent of each other, right? How you evaluate one deck is dependent on what the other decks do with it. And anytime you can add an extra layer of decision-making before a game, I like it a lot. And I really like that. Now, that format is, you know, does require the players to have more decks, right? So you can't just have one monster deck and then show up. Like, you're going to need to have probably three. So there is a little bit of a higher barrier. But on the other hand, if you're afraid of, like, one combo deck, it's highly unlikely that someone would have three copies of that combo deck, right? They probably have one copy of that combo deck. So what you could do at that point, be like, oh, I don't have an answer for that combo deck inside of my lineup. That's getting banned. Or maybe I do. Like, maybe two of my decks have an answer for it, so I'll let them play it, and then not ban. I'll ban something else that's a bigger problem.
And there's, you know, this is very, what this discussion reminds me of is when you're preparing for a major Magic tournament, and you're sideboarding, right? You have 15 cards in sideboard, and you have to decide how much of that sideboard you want to devote to countering what the prevalent meta strategy is, how much of that sideboard you're devoting to countering, you know, some crazy deck that's out there in limited versus how much you don't want to. So when you're in your situation, you could bring two decks that counter this thing that you're scared of in the meta, and that way you guarantee to have access to one of them if you have an opponent show up with, like, three Heart of the Forest decks or, like, three lands decks pre-nerf or anything like that. If you have two decks that counter it, you know you're going to have access to it. And then the whole decision spiral goes down where the opponent who's considering bringing three lands decks goes, all my opponent has to do is bring two decks with good artifact control, then I have a big problem. So it gets into this very interesting strategic cat and mouse, rock, paper, scissors thing that I think is very fascinating.
And I mean, honestly, the real reason we're talking about this is because while these are best of one formats, we all understand instinctively that Archon's a really bad format for this game, right? It promotes a certain type of deck, and then more importantly, this game just has so much variance built into it that when you say, hey guys, show up and we're just rolling the dice to see who wins, that feels kind of bad. So any layer that you add before the game actually starts is just like a pure positive. Now, obviously, we'd all prefer to do like some sort of best of three, whether it's a triad, whether it's adaptive or best of three or whatever. That's just logistically really hard to do, and I don't have any confidence in FFG to be able to run that event smoothly. But these other types of best of ones.
I mean, I will nice. Say, and you're going to get your, we are going to test your theory, because I hope you are wrong, of course, as we all do, with that FFG can run these, because the Nationals, that's coming up in 3 weeks, I think, a little over 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. At the end of this month, the Nationals in Washington, D.C. is sealed triad format. And just for your listeners, by the way, I was able to the extent that anyone can confirm these things, I was told, like, Alex told me at Gen Con, that the way we're striking decks in the sealed triad format is by houses and not by identity cards, not by looking at full deck lists, because it is sealed. So assuming that holds true, I mean, it wasn't like he didn't issue a proclamation or anything, but like that's what he said, that's his instinct as to how that would do. So assuming that's correct, I think that introduces, there are arguments for and against that, but nonetheless, it is a triad format. It is best two out of three within the format. So we're going to see how it works with some of that.
I'm honestly more excited to see how the best two out of three format works with KeyForge than the triad thing. Like, I don't even know how I'm going to ban Dex. I don't know, ban Brobnar or something in AOA. Like, that's a strategy. Ban Shadows is a strategy. Like, I don't know. But what I'm more interested in is you have to play the last two of your decks best two out of three. And I want to see how that goes for a tournament. I want to see how that runs logistically. I want to see how that plays in a sealed environment. I really have no idea, right? And that's why I'm excited to do it. I'm going to try to cast it also. We'll figure it out.
You guys, are you both coming to Nationals?
I'll be there.
You are, right?
I'll be there.
Yeah. I'm not going to be there.
I'll have my computer, we'll do what we can. But it's gonna be a crazy tournament, right? And I don't think Cascade is running it either.
They're not. So I think it's just the Nova organization.
Right.
That's my understanding.
Okay. So, this will actually give us a good litmus test, because personally, I've been working really closely with Steve and the guys at Cascade, and I think they're doing a great job. There's a lot of issues with their tournaments not starting on time, but a lot of those are mostly. Honestly, it's Wi-Fi based, and a lot of that.
Yeah, it's all technical.
It's all technical, and some of that is even GEM, right? GEM is a pretty bad program. And hey, look at this. This brings us to our last topic, I think, which is kind of just the where KeyForge is going in the future and technology that we're working with. And the place to start on that is talking about GEM. It's a very bad tournament software. It's made for tournaments that are 8 people and above, because if you're below 8 people, it doesn't correctly calculate strength of schedule, which is mind-blowing. It's not that hard to do.
I mean, they've never been able to create an app that can do strength of schedule properly. So that's par for the course for FFG. My bigger problem with GEM, honestly, is like, why can't you add or drop people properly? So if you started a tournament of GEM, let's say you have like a 20-person tournament, 2 guys show up late. Normally, in any other game, you would say, oh, we're just going to enter you guys in, and then you play each other. Or if, like, one guy comes in, you enter with a loss or something. Mm-hmm. And in GEM, like, nope, it's locked in. You can't change anything.
Daniel, tell me about what happened to you at Gen Con. Danny Trigilio?
Oh, my God. Okay, so here's what happens. I sign up, right? And I put my little app scanner thing. And it says, invalid entry. And I'm like, okay, so I just go to, like, the head guy, and after I go to the head guy, then it's like, okay, they scan it in, and they're like, and you see the error message, but then you see him look at his computer, and he's like, oh, you're in. You got your deck registered, you're fine. And I'm like, okay, well, I guess they just had an error of some sort. So then, fast forward, they do pairings, and I go to the table, and I find another guy who's also named Daniel Trujillo.
I heard about this, yes.
Yeah, so now we're... Now it's like, oh, there's 2 of us here. There's only 1 of us on the on the sheet. So, like, that error, as it turns out, was right, that they can't register 2 people with the same name. So, now they were able to get me in somehow, which was very fortunate, because it would have been really bad if, like, all of a sudden I can't enter the tournament.
That would be really unfortunate if a BDQ member wasn't able to go on the steel tournament. I would be upset about that.
That's the feels bad moment of a lifetime right there in terms of gaming, where you spend all the time and effort to travel to a major tournament, you do everything you're supposed to do, and you decide, I'm sorry, you're Danny number 2, you get, or you're Daniel number 2, you can't get into the tournament. I'm glad they fixed that. I had no idea that was the issue.
I just gotta start registering as Kira mode for every single event. Like, first name Kira, last name mode.
Some of our people put, like Nathan does this too. Nathan sticks his screen name, he puts Corey Than into into the first name, like as a namespace name and first name. So you can, maybe that'll work, I don't know.
But. Daniel Kiermo Trujillo. But yeah, like,
did not see that coming.
This just goes back to saying that FFG, come on, make a tournament software. I mean, well, there's been talk and rumors of, like, what if this game becomes like Hearthstone? What if they do make a mobile app for this game? But if they can't make a tournament software, you got to take all that off the table.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you got to figure, since the game has kind of reached a point in time at which they, I would imagine, are realizing that they need to expand their infrastructure, expand their team, expand the manner in which they're handling things. I would imagine that these things are happening. We're kind of like at the end of the first year of Vault Tour cycle. Like, we're going to do store championships, regional championships, national championships, worlds. I would expect that there'll be some revamping. I would hope there'll be some revamping of different things between now and then. We've kind of gone through season one and see what we have.
I think there was recently, within the past like month or so, an update that let them scan decks from phones and tablets into the tournament.
No, that definitely happened.
Oh, into Gem. Okay. So like, there is stuff happening, and I've heard news of, like, didn't Richard Garfield even say that they wanted to do a mobile game for this?
Well, that was the big thing. That was the thing by which people started getting really excited, because he gave an interview and he mentioned, it wasn't even like a major focal point of the interview, it was just kind of a off the cuff thing where, like, yeah, we're working on a mobile game or whatever. And then, of course, like, FFG doesn't want to confirm or deny anything. They're just kind of like, well, you know, this is Richard's position, and, you know, Richard is a great guy, we love Richard, and we're not gonna talk about it. So I think it would be lunacy not to eventually have something that would be an official digital version of the game. It could take many different formats, but it's, of course, they have to be doing that. When it comes out, I have no idea. I would love for it to come out soon, but, you know, in the meanwhile, we have some open source alternatives that we can use. So,
and they've been good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as for also, we in this topic, we want to talk about communication, because FFG has not done a very good job of communicating to us what they're doing, right? So, like, when it comes to, like, this mobile client, right, if they can just say whether or not they're trying it, right, you can say, hey, we're looking to make this, and then tell us later it ain't working out or there's delays. But, like, trying to keep hush about it, kind of a dick move on their end. But more importantly, another dick move is they just announced Prime's championships, and we don't know where they are.
We don't know when they are.
So I know in at least one situation, I believe they're having at least one of the Prime Championships theoretically before Nationals, which means sometime in the next few weeks. I don't know, like, the location of any other ones. I think one's occurring in Washington sometime, you know, in the next few weeks. And that was the thing that I was curious about, because I think my stores nearby me, I don't know if you guys have had any store championships near you, but my stores are still waiting for some products, some of the, you know, like the prizes and stuff for store championships. And as a result, like, I, to my knowledge, and I've been trying to keep tabs on things, have not had any store championships at all. So in theory, we're either going to have store championships, Prime championships, both occur before, like, very soon, before the Grand Championships. You know, again, if it's the first year, it doesn't really matter that much the order, but it's something that needs to be organized, for sure.
I mean, for me, I've been playing FFG games for a while. This is par for the course for them, again, that their communication isn't fantastic, but this is really the first time that we knew of the tournament structure, with that picture with the pyramid and then the Vault Tour off to the side, and we had all these Vault Tour tournaments, but we don't know, like, how they fit in really with the grand scheme of things and when these other Prime tournaments are happening. There was really, it feels like the last minute that they're putting this out. And I don't know, is this because of the game being popular? Is this because of them not having planned it well? I don't really know. And I hope that these tournaments run well. I bet you that we're going to hear stories of stores not having submitted their thing in time because they didn't hear about it soon enough. This whole season, I expect, is just going to be a whole mess.
What I would hope is that there's just a lot of Prime Championships, right? So, generally, Prime Championships, like, they're supposed to mimic, like, regionals. Mm-hmm. The way that they're supposed to work is, like, you get one Prime Championship for every, like, four or five states, like, in a cluster, right? So, if, like, California has one, that means Arizona, Nevada, you know, and New Mexico, they're not going to have one. If Washington has it, that means Portland, Idaho, Colorado, they're not going to have one. If that's the case, you got to announce this stuff way in advance, right? Because if you are a person that plays in Colorado and you need to go to Seattle to go to your nearest Prime Championship, you kind of need to know when it is. And what they could do is they could actually just make Prime Championships, maybe for year one, be very similar to store championships, where it's like everybody gets one. As long as your store applies for one, you get one. And then in that case, you don't really have to make announcements for it, because then it's like, yeah, your local, like
maybe
if you're,
every
you
other
live in a big city.
Normally it's every other store. I'm just biased because I'm in New York and saying every other store is a privilege for me. I don't know.
But no, I mean, I remember in Star Wars in an L5R, like Texas has like 10.
Yeah.
You know? Because like Houston has like 3, and then Dallas has a couple, and then San Antonio.
And Texas as a whole might have 2 regionals. Maybe 1 or 2.
They get 1.
Okay.
Historically. But like, that's one of those. So like, they've announced they're doing store championships, right?
Yes.
Like they said that? Yeah. So we know typically store championships happen before prime championships. Now, if you're saying that a prime championship is happening within the next month, that means they have to do them concurrently, because like store championships haven't started yet, if I remember correctly, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure. I think like the ones around me I know are just waiting for product. That's my understanding.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can't do the championship without the product. But isn't it supposed to have like a date that you schedule and it's on the FFG site and then that's your date?
For store or prime?
I think
or
both. Both. I thought it was both.
It could be. I don't know. I mean, all I know is that like for example, the stores in my area are going to try to make sense, coordinate, so they're not hosting store championships on the same day because that would be silly. So they're going to, like, I live in Indy, so they're going to try, all the stores around Indianapolis are going to try to coordinate. And there are a couple guys who run stuff around here. They're all very good at it. So they'll try to coordinate and work out different dates and such. And then I'm guessing they'll be put up on the FFG site. That would make the most sense, right? But this it is a very – assuming all of this is to happen before Nationals, and Nationals is to occur at the very end of August, we are running out of days before then. That is the major problem, that it's just like we don't really know what's happening before then other than that there are these things that are floating out there.
Right. And I mean we know the structure. I guess they are announcing it. But I wanted to wrap up news on a good note, because I will say I am very happy with how and with the tempo that they are releasing new cards and how much we know about that. Can I talk about set 3 a little bit? So yep. They gave us these teaser announcements for these new houses, which was super cool. And then they showed off all of the new houses, and then they had the Crucible cast for it. And then throughout Gen Con, whenever they weren't playing streaming official games for the tournament, they were just playing the game, playing the cards on the side, right? They had a lot of product for the new houses. They had stickers for the new houses. They were showing the cards.
Yeah, all the OP people had their own decks from the new set that they would just sit down and play randomly, and they played some on stream. But they were also just playing, for anyone who wasn't at Gen Con, what they were also doing is they were also just sitting down when they had time and playing random players. And, like they would,
I think that's fantastic and a cool way to release the stuff. And even within the set, there's the anomaly mechanic where they're talking about stuff from future sets and showing that future mechanics, potential future houses. I think that what like ideas they have for how they're going to release this game and how they're going to advertise this game, I really am happy about it. I'm excited. It gets me. I wasn't super excited about set 3, and then they dropped the new houses, and I'm like, whoa. And I saw the new
mechanics.
Some of
the mechanics are really cool. I like Exalted.
I like Ward.
And Warding's probably the most valuable ability. I don't love the way Ward is worded, but anything that says you can't just board wipe me and solves all your problems, I like that.
But
it has new levels of needing to work. And by the way, that is an affirmative way where it can be a direct response in competitive Archon to Coda, right? Like, Gateway's a really, even though it gives you chains, Gateway to Disc, for example, is a really, really good card in Coda because you don't have to do it at the end of your turn. You can Gateway and then do other nonsense. But if Gatewaying only strips off one layer of protection, it doesn't actually clear your board, and you got to Gateway twice or something like that to strip off a board, like that immediately makes decks a notch more competitive against Coda.
And that's the sort of thing that I like that they're showing off, right? Mm-hmm. Like the mechanic, I'm gonna be speculating about this set for the next couple months as it's getting revealed. But we know that they were getting a new set. We know what it looks like. We know what the cards do. We know what the mechanics are. We have an idea of how the cards are laid out based on the stuff that they've showed us, which is kind of gratuitous given their track record of showing us like one fan of cards and three select cards from the new pack every month. We know that we're going to get a new set every November and every May. That's something to look forward to. I love that.
Yeah, I do like that they finally explain what the release schedule is, because like that's been kind of just up in the air, and we haven't known, okay, are we going to get these every 3 months, every 6 months, once a year? And I said every 6 months.
We also know that in every single set, there's going to be a new set of houses. I'm sure they'll release at least one new house every set. Maybe there'll be like a legend set where they bring back all the old houses that have been wiped and it looks like Coda again, and we're like, whoa. But the fact that there's new houses every set, and we know that, is something to look forward to. I love that.
Yeah, they just keep making the houses, right? Because the reason you can't make new houses in other games is that the game will fall under its own weight if you keep doing that. Not to mention you'd have another issue of like, okay, well, if I'm playing Magic and I introduce a sixth house, I now need to create enough cards in that house to balance off with the other houses, which is a lot of work.
And commit to doing that going forward. One thing that's cool about this release cycle is that, hey, we know we're going to drop these houses off. You know, you can say goodbye to Mars and Sanctum, but they will be back. You know, they don't have to be gone forever. I love that.
And it also opens up the avenues to, for people who really like the lore of the game. It opens up the avenues to, you have these new houses coming in, and they've kind of talked about the lore a little bit. But like, what happens when set four comes around and let's say they rotate Mars back in? Right, and now Mars is battling the Star Alliance, and now that's like a natural thing that you would expect to occur. And you know, they've always had these cards in each house that are specific house target cards. Like, take that, Smarty Pants. This is Brobnar hate on Logos, right? Yep. And then you have other cards that are specific house hate. And how much is that going to be developing in future sets? And just all that sort of stuff is very fascinating in terms of the interactions, and increases the complexity and the replayability. The game already has infinite replayability, because if you literally just open a new deck and you have a whole other set of things to learn. But with the house rotational schedule, super fascinating, I think.
And I'm happy with how, and my point is that I'm happy with how they're handling it, right? For one, to not knock them. I think they're taking the success of this game and they're folding it over on itself in the right way.
Yeah.
All right, so I think that about wraps up our episode. So we kind of wanted to just give a state of the union of the game, and also like where we think there is room for improvement, because we all want this game to do exceedingly well. And it's done very well, but it can do even better. So yeah, if you want to see more of Bouncing Death Quark, you can go to Kodamron's YouTube channel. Kodamron streams quite frequently. He also will put up coverage of different vault tours. We're going to have some Gen Con info. We're also going to commentate the final match of the Gen Con game itself. We haven't done that yet, but we will do it very soon. So you can check that out on Kodamron's YouTube channel. On top of that, if you want to get to know more of us personally, you can go to our Discord. We have a Facebook and a Twitter, and they are at DeathQuark for either one of them. Via either of our social medias, you can jump into our Discord channel, which is the easiest way to talk to myself or Kodamron directly and get more information from us, bounce ideas off of us. And if you want to dive even deeper into the Bouncing DeathQuark ethos, we have an online store. Via our Discord, you can find our store. We have shirts, we have backpacks, sweaters, all sorts of good stuff that you can get to have our logo on them if you just want to represent us at cons. We were just at Gen Con, and we saw quite a bit of people that had our gear, and that was really fun. It was also an easy way to introduce ourselves, right? Like, if I saw someone with Bouncing Death Quark stuff, I would just go talk to them, you know? So that's another thing to keep in mind as well. They're very, very easy in to get to talk to us, because we're generally nice people outside of the game as well. So yeah, I am Kiramode, that's Kodamron. We have Eric, aka Justice Blinded, as well. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks a bunch.